Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
Coming up to retirement, I thought I want to do a couple of things when I retire. I don't want to wake up on Monday morning after my last day at work and say, Jesus, what do I do now, you know?
Peter, I have a tea time in the Grange Golf Club at 2:30. You can have your heart attack after that.
Now, lots of us have bucket list type ambitions to do something hugely adventurous, but not all of us actually end up doing it. And I just love to hear stories of those who did. And that's what we have for you on today's episode. Peter Murta, having retired from the Irish Times after decades of doing the work he loved to do, hopped on his motorbike and spent 8 months travelling 45,000 kilometres from the bottom of South America to the very top of North America. Peter rode alone through deserts, mountains, jungles and cities. And on this episode, he joins me to tell me about the places he saw, the people he met and what he has learned about himself and the world in the process.
This was kind of warning about, you know, bad guys, police bad guys or bandits or whatever. If you get stopped by somebody, stop the bike, take off your sunglasses, take off your helmet, turn the engine off, get off the bike and walk up to them with your hand out and say, you know, hola amigos, ¿qué tal? You know, with a big smile. And I'd be looking around me and seeing those sort of problems on a scale that was just unimaginable for most people living in Ireland. It really brought home to me that we have it very good in this country. And even the people who are struggling are nowhere near as far down the pecking order as some of the people I was seeing. You know, I said, there's no other country in the world, none at all, that has regular school massacres, shopping mall massacres. No other country has this problem. How come you have it in the United States? And he looked at me straight in the eye and he says, because we got more freedom.
This is a fascinating story. And Peter, of course, as you might imagine, is a great storyteller. And he'll be here to share it with you in just a couple of minutes' time. But listen, folks, what about the weather? Where has the summer gone? Everyone's talking about it. We've even been inundated with messages on the Mario Rosenstock hotline.
Hi, you've reached the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Please leave a message.
Hi, this is Leo Varadkar here. Mario, still enjoying the podcast. Have you noticed that ever since I announced that I won't be running for the Dáil anymore, that the weather is absolutely shocking? I'd been in the gym actually for a number of weeks. I wanted to give the good Irish public a glimpse of my buffed up abs for a couple of last see you later for old time's sake views, but absolutely nothing, just totally depressing, more depressing than the prospect of a Sinn Féin government, I expect. Anyway, yeah, carry on.
Sales at Trump International in Nuremberg are worse than Joe Biden's cognitive abilities, and that's pretty bad. This so-called climate change is not happening fast enough, folks. We need to get more drills into the ground. Drill, baby, drill. More gas into pickup trucks and start getting the planet hotter. Hotter. Faster. Drill, baby, drill. Hotter. Faster.
This is President Joe Biden or Richard Nixon. Folks, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who's president, Churchill or NASA Space Control. But what we've got to do, America, is we're a crossroads, folks. T-junction at the fork in the road and egg cup.
Mario, this is Michael O'Leary here. What a fantastic summer I'm having. An Aer Lingus strike, propping up my profits by another billion. I've just made another billion from fat, patsy-skinned Irish yobs jumping on a Ryanair plane over to Santa Ponsa or San Antonio or some other god-awful, godforsaken, sun-drenched acne spot to escape the Irish weather. If this continues, I'll be able to afford to personally buy Aer Lingus and have great crack threatening to slash pilots' pay in the process. They won't know what hit them. This is the best summer ever.
Shocking stuff altogether. And we have brand new comedy every week on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. And of course, you can contact me directly if you like at mariorosenstock@gmail.com. I read them all and get back to most of them. Come on, hit me up. So let's jump over to the studio now where Peter Murta is waiting to tell me the fascinating story of his journey from the very bottom of South America to the very top of North America, a trip he has documented in his book called From Tip to Top, The Journey of a Lifetime from Chile to Alaska. Before we kicked off properly, I was curious about what other interviews he had done so far.
So, Peter, have you done Miriam yet?
Have I done Miriam?
Yeah.
No, I haven't done Miriam, and she hasn't done me either.
Well, I was just waiting because I was looking at your biography there and this story, and, you know, it would be just a perfect Miriam story. You know, you're such an interesting story, you know, Irish Times, you know, so middle class, and it's real Radio 1 fodder.
You reckon?
Genuinely,
yeah,
it is.
Genuinely.
I'd really love that. You know, so you should, if you haven't done her already, you should really do it.
Well, if you put a word in for me,
I will. I'm
her alter ready
ego.
And able
she
and waiting.
Me all the time.
Yeah,
okay. And I'm her alter ego. But no, I say that in jest because having just read through the notes of your story is genuinely fascinating. And that's why I thought of Miriam, because that's the first thing she'd say. But, you know, not everybody has a story as interesting as yours.
Well,
and particularly this recent chapter of your story. So I'm just going to tell my listeners that you have a book called From Tip to Top.
Correct.
And this is 8 months of a journey on a motorcycle.
Yep.
From Tierra del Fuego to a place in northern Alaska called Dead Horse.
Correct. That's
and
it.
It took you 8 months to do it, a mm-hmm. trip of a lifetime, mm-hmm. which you decided to undertake. But first of all, tell me when you decided to undertake it, what age were you and what circumstances you undertook it during?
Well, I'm 71 now, and I retired in 2019, mm. age 66. And for a couple of years beforehand, that idea was in my head that when I do retire, I want to do a big trip on the motorbike.
You were in the Irish Times.
Yeah, retired from the Irish Times.
And Did they force you to retire?
They forced me to. Yeah, they threw me out. They took away, changed the locks, the whole thing. Yeah.
No, but sorry, I'm jesting. But I mean, is it expected that you retire?
Traditionally, up till very recently, everywhere it was expected you retired at 65. Mm. They extended that a few years before the hammer fell on me to 66, if you wanted to stay. And I'm sure if I had forced the issue and said, guys, I don't want to retire,
yeah.
I'm going to stay on, I doubt if they could have stopped me, you know, because you can't force somebody, I think, in law.
Because you did mention that you loved the buzz of working.
I absolutely adored it. I mean, I was so lucky in life that kind of the penny dropped when I was about 19 that I wanted to be a reporter. And at that stage in my life, the height of my ambition was to be a reporter in the Irish Times. And luckily that happened for me. And I was there for many years, not my whole career, but a good many years. And I really adored my job. Mm. And the job I liked most, although I rattled around management a bit, the job I liked most was being a reporter, being just a gumshoe reporter in the newsroom without any particular title, just chasing stories.
And no particular brief and no particular genre of story necessarily.
Well, I suppose, I mean, when I started off, I started doing crime and what have you. And I was crime and security correspondent, so quite a bit in the north. And a bit about the guards and all of that stuff. And then I
presumably
went.
Presumably you would have known Kevin Myers and Vincent Brown then.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. No, definitely. Well, Kevin was in the newsroom when I was there. Vincent had, I think, gone off to the turbine at that stage. But then I went abroad. I was in London for about 10 years and got into management work and all the rest of it. But and then I came home. And for the last probably 5 years of my time in the Irish Times, I was a managing editor in the paper, and I asked a new editor when he came in, Kevin O'Sullivan, if I could shed my management responsibilities and return to the newsroom as a reporter without any title, you know, just to be, you know, whatever the news desk threw at me. And he was a bit startled at that. Nobody had done that before. And he asked me to look after foreign for the moment, and he'd see about this. And about a year or so later, he came back to me and said, look, we can do that. So for the last 6 years or thereabouts, I was back in the newsroom. And you mentioned genre. I mean, what I liked doing more than anything else was long form reports. So when I went back into the newsroom, the first story I worked on it for a whole year, and it was about a car crash. And I ended up after a year writing about 11,000 words about this one single car crash, looking at it from every single angle possible and trying to explain what happened. So, you know, that's what I really liked doing, was burrowing into a story, getting under the skin of a story, spending a lot of time at it, and then writing what you hope is kind of the definitive account of the story. And a car crash is such an almost banal thing. You know, they happen every day. They're not banal for the people who are seriously injured or killed. But they kind of last in the news and the headlines for one or two bulletins, and then there's maybe a funeral report, and there's lots of hand-wringing, and everybody gets on with their life, except, of course, the people affected. And I just wanted to really shine a hot light on a car crash, and took the first one of this particular year that happened in the early hours of January the 1st, and just kind of researched it to death for a whole year. So that was the kind of reporting I liked doing.
And before we move on to the main point, that you're, why you're here,
yeah.
You raise a very interesting point, which we could digress for ages about.
Yeah. I mean, this long digress away.
Well, the long form journalism, yeah. And how that's pretty much one of the fundamental changes that have taken place in journalism, that there really is no budget, and there's no we're losing this. This is what journalism is, to stick at something to burrow under.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, journalism to me is about, it's about finding stuff out and explaining it to readers. And that can be political, it can be whatever. But it's there is a kind of, without being po-faced about it, there is a kind of nobility about it, that you are trying to explain the world to people so that they are better informed and they can make decisions in their own life and in politics that are well informed. And, you know, here we are on a podcast. I mean, you know, when I was the height of my journalistic career, this wasn't invented. Social media wasn't invented. And the drift away from print, the drift away from in-depth reporting and explanation has been huge. And with it has been a sort of meltdown in advertising and revenue. So traditional media, yes, finds it really, really difficult to devote resources
to
this.
Well, it costs money to have Peter Murtaugh to investigate a story for a year.
It does.
Without necessarily producing proof and a copy there and then for the next day.
Yeah.
And you said how journalism has changed. You're bloody right, it's changed. Yeah. Journalism now is a journalist ringing me up and going, Mario, can you give me 1,500 words on your Christmas best memo? I know, just your favourite Christmas present. So you want me to tell you? No, just write it up for me and send it in for me.
What was it?
Do it for you.
Yeah, and you're not going to get paid either.
I don't get paid, but I do it for you and you get paid.
Well, the number of people I see on things like Twitter / X, when you put up, say, a link to an Irish Times story or an independent story or whatever, and it's a subscriber only, and they say, it's behind a paywall. Mm. You know, you think, well, yeah, you know, the guy who wrote it, the girl who wrote it, they need to pay their mortgage and get a salary. So, you know, what do you expect them to work for free?
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm a complete sucker for that. And I laugh at myself sometimes because I pay for so many paywalls.
Really?
I have so many subscriptions, it's ridiculous. And I go out and I buy the papers as well. And my wife goes, you're such an idiot. And I go, well, yeah, but I do believe in paying for journalism.
Good.
You know? So I play. So anyway.
Do I get paid today?
No. No. Ed gets paid.
Okay.
You get paid.
Ed gets paid.
And you get paid. I don't.
Well, I get paid in a kind of a very long-winded sort of way.
Should I leave now?
No? I'm selling your books for you, pal.
You are. That's it. From Tip to Top by Gil Books.
Do you have any idea how many people listen to this podcast?
I don't, actually.
Yeah.
How
well,
many?
You'll sell a few books.
How many listen to it?
Well, I can't say that. It's that's
a state secret.
No, do you know why? Because nobody says on podcasts how many people listen.
Well, hello to you all out there. Please do buy the book.
How are you, John? Nobody says how many people listen to podcasts. Tommy Tiernan, he wouldn't tell you that. There'd be like 4 million people listening to himself and Hector just looking into the space and talking about Knock Rothery and Car Davin and Muff. Yeah, well,
they do anyway. A big dive into Muff.
Yes, indeed. So anyway, let's get on to the main part of the story. So that's Peter. For my listeners, that's Peter. You got a kind of a flavour of Peter, brief flavour. And then, Peter, you had always wanted to go on this trip, did you? You had decided later in your career?
Yeah, kind of not always. You see, I rode a motorbike when I was 17, 18, 19, and then I kind of grew up and did all the things people do, you know, and I didn't ride a motorbike. And then in my mid-50s, a pal who did ride the motorbike I now have, which for your bike listeners is a BMW R1200 GS Adventure.
Is that a touring bike?
Yeah, it's a touring bike, although tourers are a different kind of shape.
Okay.
But yeah, it's an enduro. It's a big, big bike. It's the bike for going around the world, basically.
Okay.
So it's a big bike. He offered to borrow one for me and the pair of us would head off. And I did that. And at the end of it, I just thought, oh, my God, you know, this is just fantastic.
Yeah.
So that got me back onto it in my mid-50s. And I bought one and I went in and out of work to the Irish Times on it for years. And when they sent me out on reporting jobs, I went on the bike and what have you. And So it was, as I say, coming up to retirement, I thought I want to do a couple of things when I retire. I don't want to wake up on Monday morning after my last day at work and say, Jesus, what do I do now, you know?
Peter, I have a tea time in the Grange Golf Club at 2:30. You can have your heart attack after that.
I'm not into golf.
No, I knew you're not.
So anyway, I decided, look, I'm going to do a big biking journey. So then it was a question of, well, what do you do? And yeah. I just thought, well, this is one of the great motorbike rides from the bottom of South America to the top of North America, or the other way around, which is actually how most people do it. So I decided to go from the bottom, from Tierra del Fuego, up through South America, Central America, and up to a place called Prudhoe Bay, which is the heart of the Alaskan oil industry. And it's at the end of a, I think it's a 700-mile long gravel road called the Dalton Highway.
A 700-mile?
Yeah, yeah. And it was built in...
By the Americans?
Yeah, it was built by the American oil industry and something I can't remember now exactly.
700 miles? Yeah. Is it largely straight?
No, it winds and it goes through a mountain range called the Brooks Range. And actually about a third of it now is paved and the rest is gravel, but it was built in something like 150 or 170 days. I can't remember. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Amazing.
It is amazing.
So when you started in Tierra del Fuego, presumably that's quite a cold part of the world, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is in winter. I started there, as you say, I had two goes at this. First time was interrupted by COVID.
Yeah.
So second,
do you know what? We'll skip the
COVID. You skip COVID, yeah. Everybody should
pretend you never.
Yeah,
never
that's right.
So you started in Tierra del Fuego.
I started in November, which of course is their spring.
Yeah.
So their spring grew into their summer as I went up through Argentina and Chile and into Bolivia. And then I was into the tropics, and then I came into the spring in the United States. So I kind of had 8 months of spring and summer,
yeah,
which was sort of extraordinary.
And you stayed in a mixture of hostels, B&Bs, Airbnbs or tents? Or?
For the most part in South America, it was hostels because they're so good and they're so cheap and they're safe and they're full of nice, interesting people.
Nice.
But then in Central America and in particular in North America, it was all camping or nearly all camping. Again, because the cost of hotels and hostels in the United States is incredible. Okay. Like it's very hard to get a motel for less than 100, 120 quid.
Okay.
Whereas a campsite is, you know, 20, 25, 30 quid.
And you did this on your own, Peter?
I did.
Yeah. That's a funny one because I don't know. I suppose I'd be like a lot of people. I would probably say to myself, I don't know if I can do this on my own. Not because I'm afraid, but because of company. Of solitude, of loneliness.
Well, I wanted that.
Yeah.
I wanted to be on my own, not because I'm not a gregarious person and I don't like people. I love them and I'm very gregarious and anybody who knows me will, you know, I talk to people all the time. But it was because I wanted, over this 8 months, I wanted my own mind and my own focus to be on the places that I was seeing and the people I was meeting, not my pal and sort of saying, you know, where are we going to go today and blah, 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 you know, what do you think of that? So my focus was on who I was meeting and where I was. And of course, I was writing all the time in the Irish Times. And so that was...
You were keeping a diary or no?
Not so much keeping a diary. I was keeping notes. So I brought a whole pile of notebooks with me and I was making notes every day. And every couple of days I'd stop and I'd write. I'd write something for the Irish Times and I'd write something for a website that I was running at the time called tip2top.ie. And it's still there. Mm. And anybody can read what I was writing at that time. So... yeah, not so much a diary, but as I say, every couple of days, especially coming up to deadline with the paper, I'd stop and I'd crank out a few thousand words.
All right. I don't know where to start here. So you started in South... Well, I mean, let's just...
Tierra del Fuego.
I'll just see if I can pepper you with some questions. Like, you started in South America.
Yeah.
What had you known about South America? And was South America different to your personal experience of South America, Argentina and Bolivia and all these places in Chile, different to your actual...
I didn't know a huge amount, though. I had been there before. I'd been to Chile before and I had been to Mendoza in Argentina, you know, only for a day or two. And I'd been to Brazil for a week or two. But I couldn't say that I knew it at all. Was it very different? It was kind of what I expected. I suppose what struck me most, and this struck me really by the time I got to Mexico, this was getting in on me, getting in my head, was where you come across disparities between the haves and the have-nots, where you come across inequalities, they are gross and really severe. And it hit me quite a lot. You know, I'd be in the hostel in the morning or in my tent or something, and I'd get on the phone and I'd you know, plug into RT and listen to the news or what have you, or I'd go on Twitter or Facebook. And what was coming back from Ireland was a lot of, this country's a kip, it's full of corruption, you know, people can't manage, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd be listening to that and I'd be looking around me and seeing those sort of problems on a scale that was just unimaginable for most people living in Ireland. It really brought home to me that we have it very good in this country. Mm. And even the people who are struggling are nowhere near as far down the pecking order as some of the people I was seeing, in, particularly in Central America.
Yeah, you raised such an interesting point there. I mean,
I know all these things are relative, but...
No, you
know.
It is relative, but everybody claims to be unhappy, yeah. Really. The more and more you do analysis of sort of society now in Northern Hemisphere, people complain more and more of just being unhappy and anxiety-ridden. And we can go into social media and everything, and we know why that is, and it's partly... But really what it overlooks is the fact that life has, in many ways, has never been so good for so many people. Yeah. Even if you just take the things like, you know, a hot shower.
Yeah.
Like a hot shower is something that a hundred years ago nobody had.
Yeah.
Nobody had a hot shower, not even a millionaire.
Well, even at a more basic, like Ireland now has the second highest longevity in Europe. Yeah. You know, we are living longer as Irish people than everybody else in Europe, bar one country. I'm not sure which that one is, probably Sweden or Finland. So, you know, that says something. I mean, a child born today has a reasonable expectation of living to 100 in Ireland. I, at 71, have a reasonable expectation of living into my 80s. That is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And there were many times on this trip where, you know, I'd meet some character and we'd be chatting, you know, and he'd say, after a while, you know, how old are you? Cuantos años? You know, how old are you?
Cuantos años tienes?
And I'd say, you know, I'm 70. And there were a couple of times they were really shocked.
Yeah.
Guys were really
life
shocked because they were in their late 50s and they looked as old, if not older than me.
Life expectancy is lower.
Because
and so
were
you were getting
hard.
This stuff back from Ireland and you were comparing it to the rank kind of poverty that you were looking outside in South America, and you were just going, God, we have it so good.
Yeah. Now, it wasn't everywhere. I wouldn't like to give the wrong impression. I mean, Chile is it's both stable and it's prosperous and it's economically prosperous country. It's a great country. Mm. But certainly there are places in Argentina, in Bolivia, Peru in particular. Like, I came across quite a lot of political unrest in Peru, and at the bottom of that political unrest was people who were poor. And we're just demonstrating and demanding a better life. They weren't articulating that. The focus of it was on the presidency. But that was the basis of it. They were poor people.
One of the things you said in your notes, which really grabbed me because it's probably just a personal thing that I have, is the more you travelled and the more you met people and saw people, the more your faith was restored in the humanity, just basic human decency, the decency of strangers to each other.
Yeah.
And the importance, and I think this is really important as well, the importance that you try to open up to people and try and go with an open mind to people and to not show fear to people.
Mm.
And that when you show openness and an open hand and a smiling face and eyes that are greeting them, that people respond surprisingly quickly and surprisingly positively. It's Talk to me a little bit about that.
It's very true. Well, it was a bit of advice I got from a couple of characters here. Ken McGreevy, who's actually a guard at Malahide, and his pal, John O'Kelly, who's they're both bikers. And they're a lot more experienced than me. And they kind of gave me a bit of advice that I sort of knew already, but hearing it back from them really made me take it on board. And that was, look, if you get stopped, and this was kind of warning about, you know, bad guys, police bad guys or bandits or whatever. If you get stopped by somebody, stop the bike, take off your sunglasses, take off your helmet, turn the engine off, get off the bike and walk up to them with your hand out and say, you know, hola amigos, ¿qué tal? You know, with a big smile. And it just diffuses and breaks the situation. And it did. And I didn't really have problems with, I didn't have any problems with bandits and few enough problems with police. But in Peru, these political demonstrations, it was quite edgy. And I had been warned not to proceed I was warned in Bolivia not to try and go north through Peru or through these roads because they were all blocked. And I thought, I can get through this. So I went along and sure enough came to all the roadblocks and people were manning them and they had rocks and what have you, and there was glass and burning tires and crap all over the roads. And I just stopped and got off the bus. And they were all shouting at me, you know, no passer, you know, you can't come through. But when I got off and engaged with them and talked to them and listened to what they had to say, they realised that I wasn't trying to challenge them. I wasn't trying to burst my way through and say, you know, excuse me, you know, you can't stop me. I have a right to go through here. That, none of that was going on. And they suddenly became interested in me. And one of the first of these roadblocks, there was a guy with a bullhorn who was marshalling the demonstrators. And after a second or two, he gave me the bullhorn and said, talk to them, you know. Now, my Spanish is like really, really, really grim. But OK, so I told them, you know, soy periodista, I'm a journalist, and soy viaje a Tierra del Fuego, Alaska, you know, I'm traveling. Yeah. And at the word of Alaska, you know, Alaka, they're like, ooh, yeah. They were suddenly interested in me and they were interested in the bike. Yeah. And after a few minutes, you know, there was kind of applause and clapping on the back, you know, and they let me through. Yeah. So that kind of brought it home to me. And the other thing that really brought it home to me was in Colombia. I spent about a week with some migrants, some of the illegal migrants. Right now, we know all about this in Ireland today. So these people were on the Gulf of Darien, which is on the edge of the Caribbean, and they were getting boats across a mouth of water to another part of Colombia that had a border with Panama. There's no road between South America and Central America, right? You've got to fly or go by sea.
Okay.
So these people were going across, and at the other side, they were met by people who were walking them through the jungle into Panama. When I went to this place called Necloclí, there were 1,000 people a day, every day, on the beach waiting for ferries with all their worldly possessions in black plastic bags and wheelie suitcases, young mothers with babies in pouches on their bellies, young men, older men, a mass of people all trying to get to the United States. They were from Venezuela, where 7 million people have left that country in the last, I think, 10 or 15 years because of the political problems there, looking for a better life. They were from Haiti, and bizarrely, they were from China.
Yeah.
And so spending a lot of time with these people and then coming across the narrative that you come across in Texas and Arizona and the wall, the border, you know, these people weren't drug dealers. They weren't gangsters. They weren't rapists. They were ordinary poor people, like ordinary poor people anywhere who were looking for a better life. And it was really quite sobering to spend time with them and to see what they were trying to do and what they were prepared to go through to get what you and I have.
Wow.
Which is a reasonable life.
One, the mind boggles.
Mm.
All we see is the reports in the Western world. All we see are generally the reports of huddled masses near or at the border.
Yeah, well,
so that's our image.
Yeah.
But when you crystallise it down, when you put it there, you said 7 million from Venezuela. I mean, to go through that horror, what must you be leaving?
Sure.
But do you know what they're leaving? I mean,
well,
the whole place on fire?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly in Venezuela, I didn't go into Venezuela. I just crossed the frontier just with Colombia and hung around there for a few minutes. But in deference to, you know, people who would have feared for my safety, I didn't go into Venezuela. But, you know, there is political violence there. But I think probably more than anything else, there's hopelessness. There's economic hopelessness. There's poverty. People see no future. And they think, I'm 25, I'm 30. Like, I met this guy at the frontier. Cúcuta. That was the name of the town. The Colombian city of Cúcuta is right on the border with Venezuela. And I met this guy and he had what was obviously an instrument case. And it was a violin case. And he was a violinist. Yeah. And he was leaving Venezuela. And he said to me initially, oh, I'm going to, I think he said he was going to Bogota or something. And then when he got to know me a bit better, he said, you know, I'm not going there. And he was trying to get to the States. And they're just people flooding out of a country out of hopelessness. They are not looking for anything more than you and I are looking for. And they're making a journey of several thousand kilometers in extreme conditions. When I got to Texas, first of all, when I was with these people in Colombia and across the Darien Gulf and up to the edge of Panama, I obviously had to leave them there because, like, I'd left my motorbike behind, and I just couldn't go on. But when I got to Texas, CNN one night, one Sunday night, CNN had this fantastic report, very lengthy report from one of their journalists who stayed with the migrants and walked with them through the jungle into Panama. And he was stepping over bodies and people were being attacked. And I mean, it was like, you know, it was a bit like no man's land on the Western Front. It was appalling. And this is what people were prepared to try and navigate through, often with children, with babies, for a better life. And as I say, to then read and kind of experience the narrative in the United States about migration, it's pretty hard to take. And then to see this wall, I mean, it's not a wall, it's a huge fence about 30 meters high along southern Arizona that's keeping people out. I mean, it's not a solution. I understand why it's there and the political argument about it. But, you know, the solution to these problems is in Venezuela. It's in Haiti. It's giving people where they live a reason to stay where they live. I mean, we know this more than any other country. How many of us went to Boston and New York and would have stayed because of economic necessity.
Exactly. Or because of the famine. And then in our living memory with the despair of the 80s.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and had those things not happened. So the solution to this problem
is here.
Is here. Mm-hmm. Wasn't that sort of customs in JFK Airport, New York,
correct,
or the Mexican border. It's here.
Another one you bring up, which is a very interesting one, you just touched on it very briefly there, and it's fascinating to anybody who's looking at world affairs at the moment. It's something I'd like to learn more about or hear more about. Mm. You said China.
Yeah.
And what's emerging out of the migrant situation going into America is that, as you said, an awful high percentage are Chinese.
Yeah.
But they're not poor Chinese. A lot of them are middle class Chinese,
yes,
which is a strange one.
Yeah. The Chinese thing, apart from what I could see myself, I got from the UN Office of Migration. On this place, Negloclí, there were two kind of NGO operations on the beach helping and advising people. One was by the Colombian Red Cross and the other was the UN International Office of Migration. And they didn't encourage or facilitate people, but they tried to warn them, you know, what they were doing and what they needed to think about. And at the UN, when I got talking to a lady who was at one of the kind of hatches, you know, giving information to people, and she told me that 75% of the people that she was dealing with every day were Chinese. Mm. And I was blown away by this. The only two guys I got talking to were two young fellas on the other side up by the frontier with Panama, whom I met when I went across the bay myself in one of these boats. And all they could tell me, because of the language problems, was that they were from Shanghai. And there were two bright-eyed, smiling young guys who looked middle class, if that's not an odd thing to say. That, you know, they didn't look rough and ready. They looked like guys who might have paid somebody, you know, $1,000 or two to get to where they got so far. And they were heading to America looking for a better life. Mm. I heard afterwards that a lot of the explanation for the Chinese migration is that they can fly into Ecuador without visas. Now, I'm not sure if that's true. Traveling from China to Ecuador, you don't need a visa.
Right.
But it has been said to me.
Because I believed the conspiracy theory all along, Peter.
Which is?
Well, that the G is placing an active army in Texas.
Okay.
To launch the attack on America. God damn it. I thought that was the answer.
Where are the lizard people in all of
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is it. This is, of course, one of the conspiracy theories. They're putting an active army in there slowly.
Yeah.
And if the active army doesn't take over America, it'll be worse. They'll become Democratic voters.
Well, all they're doing, I tell you, by the time I got to Vancouver in Western Canada, there are so many people from Hong Kong, I believe, but certainly from the Chinese neck of the woods, as it were. So many people from that living there. that the road signs, the name, street names, you know, Grafton Street in Vancouver, whatever it might be, is in English, French, French Canadian, and Mandarin Chinese. Yeah, yeah. And the economic vibrancy you can see there from the Chinese community, small shops, restaurants, etc. That is the effect of successful migration, is that you get this huge economic boost.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And that's well known. If only the UK would bear that in mind, they might get a little bit of a boost. Yeah. Anyway, that's another
story.
That's another day's work. So now, forgive my ignorance of this. So then you're on your bike, and they're migrants. They're going nowhere, but you're going on your bike. Do you have a visa then to get into the United States? Because you're going through the wall.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, the whole visa.
Does that mean you have a visa? You have a temporary visa. Holiday visa.
Well, as it happened, before I embarked on this journey, I applied for and got an I visa, which as a working journalist. Once before going to the States, I on a tourist visa with the ESTA thing, and a tourist visa, just going over for a fortnight. I was questioned as I was getting on the plane and, you know, what do you do for a living? I'm a journalist. And you go, no, it's a holiday. And I said, but I might take a few notes and write a travel piece. And bang.
Work.
I was like, oh, yeah, work. Step this way, sir, you know. And I ended up having to swear on a Bible and all the rest of it. It was extraordinary. And so I just thought, this time I'm not going to mess around. No. I am going to be working. I am going to be writing. I am going to be sending to the Irish Times. So I just thought, I'll do this above board. So I applied for and was given an I visa. For the US. But every other country, the Irish passport is enough to get you in at the frontier as a tourist for 90 days or whatever.
Yes.
And equally, a lot of people asked me about the bike. It was a Wicklow Reg bike that made this journey. And it's easier to take a bike from your own country if you're going through, because like if you hire a bike in Chile or buy one in Chile, how do you get it into Argentina, blah, 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 you know, all the rest. And how do you sell it at the far end? It's easier to take your own bike.
Okay.
And you get a temporary customs pass to go through the country, and you surrender that on the other side, and then you get a new one. And it only takes minutes. It's all fairly standard. So no visa problems, no customs problems.
And off you biked into America.
And off I biked.
Enduring, and especially after what happened last weekend with Trump, into one of these like most divided places in the world in its history. You know, it's as divided as it was before the 68 situation in America, and maybe the Civil War 100 years previous to that. It's as divided as it's ever been.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't make huge pronouncements. I wasn't there that long, but certainly my impression is yes, it's hugely divided. There's an extraordinary amount of anger in the States, and it's anger from every side. And it's about everything, you know. It's about gays, it's about pride, it's about metropolitan elites, it's about the uneducated, it's about the Democrats, the Republicans. Everybody is really angry about everybody else. And in the mix of that great soup of kind of cultural and political anger, you have this extraordinary access to guns. And of course,
you ended up at a gun fair as well, didn't you?
Yeah, in Tucson, in Arizona.
I would say that's a pretty weird experience.
It's weird to walk into a gun fair with a notice on the door outside saying no guns allowed inside. and you walk in and there's like 500 million AR-15s on display, you know, and these guys walking around and they're all looking at these military style guns, and you think this is insane. This is mad, mad.
And they refuse to make the connection between the increased the vast number of deaths through guns in America and the guns themselves.
That's right.
They keep on having blokes coming on TV going, "It ain't guns that kill people, it's mental health."
Yeah. Do you know how many people die in the United States every year from guns, according to the latest figure?
I'm going to have a guess at that, Peter, because I got my first guess with you quite right about Norway. So I think I'm going to go for about 100,000.
No, not that many. No. Thankfully, it's about 42,000.
Right.
And I think about 15,000 or so of those are suicide. So if you deduct that, you know, it's a rather odd thing to do, but deduct that, you're still talking about well over 20,000 people are dying through gun violence. Mm. That's extraordinary.
It is. And that AR-15 you talked about was the very bullet, gun that shot at Trump.
Yeah, and it's known as America's gun.
And he is the biggest supporter of the AR-15.
Yeah.
You know, and actually just recently I saw just in three southern states, which you would have passed through. And the listeners would love to hear this because they haven't heard it already. It was because it's just boggle. Your mind boggles. So now ammunition is being passed through Congress as being introduced into vending machines.
Yeah.
Vending machines.
Yeah.
Ammo.
Yeah. I know.
It's a laugh. You laugh.
I had one conversation with a lengthy conversation with a guy at the Tucson gun fair where I said, you know, I said, there's no other country in the world, none at all, that has regular school massacres, shopping mall massacres, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No other country has this problem. How come you have it in the United States? And he looked at me straight in the eye and he says, because we got more freedom.
Yeah, that's a very, very strange answer. They're also under the misapprehension. I do a lot of thinking about America, but they're also under the misapprehension that they're the only people in the world that have democracy and freedom.
Mm.
Sweden doesn't have democracy. Norway has no democracy.
Sure.
You know, the UK is a dictatorship. Ireland is some sort.
Well, I mean, the likely next vice president of the United States, Mr. Vance, only yesterday, the day he was confirmed as the vice presidential candidate, said that the United Kingdom, since the Labour Party won the election, is now the world's first Islamic country with nuclear power. I mean, that is just like so off the wall.
Hmm. It is completely batshit crazy.
It is, I'm afraid.
That's hat stand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyway, look, the other thing about all of this is that there's a kind of point counterpoint or a bizarre side to this. You come across these attitudes, you come across this hardware and this culture of guns and, as you say, the link to freedom and all the rest of it. And at the same time, they're the nicest people you could meet. They are so pleasant and so nice and so warm and friendly. And if I had said to any of these people, you know, if they said, you know, where are you going? And I'd said something like, oh, well, I'm not really sure. I haven't got my accommodation for the night sorted out yet. I've no doubt whatsoever that they all would have said, oh, you must come back to my place. We'd love to have you stay. You know, come back and eat with us and have dinner with us and blah, blah, blah. So they're really warm and friendly and open in that sense. But then when you get on to these narrow subjects.
Correct.
Like guns, and I think God would be another.
I remember even thinking, just to spread it wider a bit, you remember Borat, and do you remember Borat's trip to the United States?
Yes.
And I thought that some of it, you know, obviously we know what Borat does, and it's set up, he sets it up and everything, and it's like a massive prank. And then he went after the sort of Trumpies, and he wanted to do a trick on them.
Mm.
And, you know, he was, you sleep with your daughter, I sleep with my daughter, she prostitute. And all this, right? And they're there. I don't understand, sir. What are you saying? Now, what came across, of course, if you forget the joke and you forget the ha 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 Borat, was how decent and nice these Trumpers were.
Yeah, yeah.
And accommodating him every hand's turn, trying to be. They were sitting ducks for his thing, but it backs up what you say, the politeness. There's a lot of Southern politeness going on there as well. And the sort of decency and the humanity and the kind of the personal the idea in America of, you know, the not to have a nice day, but like they're very interested in other people. America's one of the few people you can sit at a bar and start a conversation with the person next to you. You literally can.
Sure.
And
there is a great
in Ireland, warmth. Funnily enough, a fellow will look at you strange, you know, and you'll go, like, what do you want, boy?
Yeah.
We think we're hilariously friendly.
Yeah.
Well, we're suspicious as well.
Yeah.
In America, they're genuinely kind of.
They are. I mean, at one state in California, in Northern California, I was, I parked the bike outside a supermarket and I was going in to get something for the evening. And I came out and this guy was looking at the bike and he was looking it up and down. And so we got talking. And, you know, he said, you know, where are you staying tonight? And I said, I don't know. I'm going up the road there. He said, come back to my place.
That's mad.
And you can stay, you know. And I sort of said, well, that's very kind of you. And as he was saying, you know, follow me and my truck's here. And as we were kind of parting and I was getting on the bike to follow him, I said to him, I said, I guess we're going to find out which one of us is the axe murderer.
Woo-hoo!
And we sort of both laughed at this. But he brought me to his home on the edge of a redwood forest up the road with his lovely wife, a beautiful home called Enchanted, and they gave me a lovely room and a meal, and they invited the neighbours in, and we had a lovely evening, and it was really nice. Now, you know, he wasn't expressing any crazy views of that, but that was just an example of nice homespun hospitality, friendliness.
Amazing.
And the next day he showed me many places along the coast there and just wished me well.
Yeah. You
lovely.
I think we talked enough about America. I mean, because we could spend two hours on
America. You could spend a lifetime talking about
it. And then you went through Canada, Vancouver, did you say?
Yeah, I went from Washington State on the ferry across to Vancouver Island and the city of Victoria, and then across to Vancouver itself. And as
are Canadians as polite as they say?
They are. I mean, going from Northern California on, people were getting warmer and friendlier and more liberal and nicer. And then in Canada, they're just gorgeous, you know, really lovely.
Did you ever hear that joke about Canada? How do you get? I think it was Paul Noonan from Bell X1 told this good to joke on the radio, and he said, "How do you get 100 Canadians out of a swimming pool?"
Uh huh. How?
Just say, "Would you mind please getting out of the pool?" And everybody's out straight away because they just understand that kind of language. They just follow the instructions.
Well, I met this guy on the ferry going across, and because of the conversation I had with him, I did this huge detour, and I'm so glad I did. This guy turned out to be and he was a biker, which is how we got talking. He had a faux Harley of some sort. Anyway, we got talking, and he turned out to be the director of drug policy for the whole of British Columbia. So he was part of the civil service, and he was enunciating policy and developing policy on all of this. And British Columbia legalized cannabis in, I think, 2019, maybe 2018. And a few months previously, they had decriminalized hard drugs. And so they're two kind of separate stories. But I was fascinated by what he was saying about cannabis. His name was Cameron Deekson. And I said, "Look, I'd like to write about that. Where should I go to see the effect of this?" And he said, "Go east, go to the Kootenays, go to a place called Nelson. And you'll see a burgeoning craft industry of farmers growing cannabis and shops selling cannabis and cannabis sweets and medication and all this, blah, 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 blah." So I thought, this is fascinating because we're beginning to have this debate here in Ireland. Mm. So I went there, spent about a week there and wrote a lengthy piece for the Irish Times about this and the effect it has had on Canada. And just in case anybody's worried, it's had no bad effect as far as I can see. I think hard drugs is a different story. But because I was over there, I thought I can't kind of turn back and head in the direction I was thinking. I got to see the Canadian Rockies that were only down the road. And my God, I mean, to go over the Kootenay Pass into Alberta towards Banff and then up a thing called the Icefield Parkway to Jasper. I mean, the scenery is just... It literally is jaw-dropping. And I'm stopping the bike every couple of miles because I can't believe the vista in front of me. The landscape, nature, the majesty of the whole thing is fabulous. And that was one of the best experiences.
I see. And then the journey ends in Alaska.
Yeah, through the Yukon.
And you did go to this place called Dead Horse, which is a kind of a town.
No, it's not actually. No, I thought it was a town. And as I was going along the Dalton, I was thinking, you know, I'm quite nervous.
That's the 700-kilometre
gravel road and what have you. And I'm a bit nervous about this. And I get more confident as no disasters happen and I manage the gravel and all the rest of it. And I'm thinking, I can't wait to get to Dead Horse. And I'm going to have a beer. And I'm going to, you know, it's going to be, this is 8 months and 44,000 kilometres. This is going to be just great. And I arrive in Dead Horse. First of all, there's no town. It's just a series of huge, big contractors' compounds serving the oil wells that are all land-based. So there's loads of trucks and there's loads of barbed wire and there's loads of pipes and there's loads of gantries and blah-dy, blah-dy, blah. And there's a couple of kind of sleep house blocks, one of which is a hotel. And there's a single petrol station which has no staff in it. You just a credit card, you stick into a hole. And there's one store which sells Stanley knives and spanners and ratchet drivers and boiler suits. And upstairs, they have a little counter selling stickers for the bikers. And that's it. No beer.
Could you not have picked a better place to end your mammoth epic journey?
I know.
What an anticlimax.
Yeah, what an anticlimax. Yeah, and then I saw a grizzly bear on the road, and that was a whole incident. Yeah,
they were kind of hinting at what a dead horse isn't positive.
No, it's not. It's not. But I mean, what a place. What an extraordinary
Shangri-La,
place.
Yes. Dead horse, not
no,
so much.
No. So I had to wait for my beer until I got back down again.
I'm interested in how you punctuated the end of the journey, as in, you reached the end of your journey.
Yeah.
How did you feel at the end of your journey?
A bit, a mixture of being a bit flat and also being elated that, like, I had done it, and that was, you know, I did feel a kind of personal triumph. Look, I set out to do this thing and I've actually done it now. And, like, you know, I'm a bit chuffed. I'm a bit pleased with myself.
And did you feel a little bit of an emotion?
Yes, I did. Absolutely.
I can see this.
Absolutely. No, I did. What I did at the very end, there is a guy up there who organises tours of the oil fields, and you have to register and show your passport because there's a huge security issue. So I did all that. Went on the tour with probably about a dozen other people, other tourists, who I don't think any of them were bikers. There were other tourists. They'd driven up in camper vans and what have you. And we went around, and the thing to do, as far as I was concerned, is have a swim in the Arctic Ocean. Mm. So they show you the oil fields, and then they bring you to the edge of the water. And myself and I think two others got in for a swim, and the other tourists there were cheering and applauding, and they knew what I had done. And at that moment, I felt quite emotional that they were congratulating me and all the rest of it. And sort of when I got up out of the water, I realised that really is the end, you know.
So I would have thought there would be a kind of a powerful sense of closure, ending, and emotion in from just personally. There was.
But of course, I mean, I had to get home. So I had to get back down from Dead Horse.
Get the fuck out of Dead Horse.
Yeah, and back over the Brooks Range and back to Fairbanks and back down.
So you had a long journey back as well.
I had a long journey back to Vancouver.
Okay.
And to come home.
I have two more questions for you. You talked a lot about, in your notes there, you mentioned that it was 8 months and that you wanted to do it alone and that there was a sense of solitude, but that was something you had desired.
Yeah.
And you said that you could do a lot of thinking. Did you do a lot of thinking, and is there such thing as doing a lot of thinking? Because we all think, you know, I'll tell you what I need now. I'm a bit busy now, and the work is tough. I'd love to get out there now to Avoca in Wicklow now, to a cabin now for a couple of weeks and do a bit of fucking thinking. My question is, do you actually do any thinking?
Yeah, you do. I find myself that I'm kind of rattling around inside my helmet when I'm on the bike and I'm trundling along. And I don't have any music or anything like that, so I'm just thinking about things. And frequently I'm thinking about the morning before or the day before or last night, and I'm working out, okay, which bit of it do I want to write about? And that bloke was actually boring, and I don't want to write about that hostel and that mountain range, but I do want to write about this now. How am I going to phrase that? So I'm actually writing in my head quite a bit of the time. But a lot of the time, yeah, I was thinking, and I was thinking of home, and I was thinking of my wife and home, and I how much I missed her, and the children and the dogs and, you know, friends and all that. But I wasn't particularly lonely. I'm comfortable in my own company, although I like company enormously, and I like other people. But as I said before, I wanted on this journey, if I was with other people, that it would be the people I met. Yeah. So I did think, and people have asked me, you know, kind of, what did you learn? You know, what's the big lesson out of all of this? And it is that thing that, people everywhere are actually quite like you. They're quite like me. They're not that different. And B, they're almost invariably kind and warm and welcoming. And if you need help, if you ask for help, you'll get it. And there's nothing to fear from them.
Yeah, that's a nice thing to say.
Yeah.
The last one is, you're very, very sprightly, 71-year-old. Like, you're in very good nick.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, and...
Well, I was just with the doctor this morning having a checkup, another 50,000-mile checkup, and he said, good to go.
Good to go, yeah. So I'm wondering, are you good to go and where?
Oh,
do you want? Is that a kind of it? Have you turned your mind to other things now, or would you? Did it give you a desire, a grow to take something else on?
Yeah, I mean, there are other stories I would like to research and write. One is, it's not a biking story, but there is a kind of personal story that I'd like to work on. I'd like to do more biking. I mean, I mentioned I'm just back from a couple of weeks up in Norway. I'm not sure I'll ever do anything quite as ambitious as this. I mean, it's asking a lot of my wife, you know, asking a lot of her to allow me to do something like that, and the worry it puts on her, which is, you know, I'm sort of conscious of that. But leaving that to one side for the moment, I'd like to go across Russia. I'd like to go across the Stans, but I'm not sure if
the
I
what?
Will. The Stans.
What's that?
Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan. Right. You know, the Silk Road, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
That would be quite nice.
Yeah, the Stans, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but we'll see.
Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
What are the Stans, other? You said Kazakhstan.
Borat Stan.
That's Borat Stan. That's Kazakhstan. Prostitute. So listen, I'm inspired by your story. I genuinely am, and you tell it really well, as I would expect a journalist to. And thank you so much for talking to me.
No, and I'll be telling it again, just if I can mention, on August the 3rd and the 4th, books at 1. Oh, Saturday, August the 3rd in Letterfrack at 4 o'clock, books at 1. And Sunday the 4th in Lewisburg, books at 1. At 3 p.m. So if anybody's in that neck of the woods, Letterfrack in Galway and Lewisburg in Mayo, do come along to Books at One. I'm sure I'll rattle away and show a few pictures.
Are you going by bike?
I'm not sure if I can. I'll have to probably bring
Go Éirin Road, Éirin. Please. The tea trolley's gone long ago.
Oh, really?
You'd have better supplies on your bike.
Okay, yeah, well, I'll bring a little stove.
Tea or coffee? Then, yeah. Coffee, tea. Tea or coffee? Coffee or tea? The book is called Tip to Top. Top to Tip. Tip to Top.
Tip to
from
Top.
Tip to Top.
Tip to Top, yeah.
Journey from Tierra del Fuego to that place in Dead Horse.
Yeah.
Where there was no beer.
Yeah.
All right. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for this week from the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Thanks for joining me. Remember to get in touch with me personally if you have any ideas of who you'd like to hear on the show, constructive criticisms, or just downright compliments. Same time, same place next week. See you then.